Hi there. It's Vicky with the Talking Information Center. It is June 2nd, 2026, and today I'll be reading Harper's Magazine, the May 2026 edition. Readings. Voir dire, Musk, be impartial. From the jury selection proceedings for Giuseppe Pampana versus Elon R. Musk, a civil trial held in March in the U.S. District Court of the Northern District of California concerning allegations that Musk made public statements to drive down the stock price of Twitter shortly before acquiring the company. Some 40 potential jurors were excused from the proceedings after declaring that they could not remain impartial in the trial. Judge Charles R. Breyer. Elon Musk is a public figure. He is the founder of Tesla, SpaceX, SolarCity, PayPal. PenPal? What is it? A number of companies that are cutting edge, leading technological wonders of our lives today. In your questionnaires, I asked you all, do you have any opinions about Elon Musk and or his political activities? And I want to say there is nothing wrong with a person having a view as to Mr. Musk. In this country, you are entitled to have views, pro and con, on everything, and that's what makes this democracy great. The question is, whatever your opinion is of Mr. Musk, or Twitter, or Tesla, can you set it aside and judge the defendant based solely on the evidence that produced in this trial, and the law as I give it to you? Okay, juror number three, you have an opinion about Mr. Musk. Juror number three, correct. Judge Breyer. If you are a juror in this case, are you able to say, I know what I thought about him, because obviously it is not humanly possible not to think about something. I guarantee you, as soon as I say the word elephant, everyone thinks about an elephant. Even if I say, don't think about an elephant. When I say the word elephant, most of you will have an image of an elephant. You can't get it out of your mind. But it is possible to say, even though the judge said elephant, I was told I can't regard it. When I look at that zoo out there, this is probably the wrong analogy to use, but when I look at that zoo out there, I'm not going to think about elephants. I'm going to think of lions and tigers, but I won't think of elephants. Even though I know they're there, I'm going to pretend they're not in the zoo, okay? That's what I'm asking you all to do. I'm asking you, can you pretend, can you say, I'm going to do this fairly, I'm going to do this rationally, I'm going to use my mind to do it and not be governed by some other experience. Are you able to do that? Juror number three. Yes, I am, Your Honor. I can set aside the facts. Judge Breyer. I'm sorry? Juror number three. I mean, I can set aside my opinion or whatever I have. I can do that. Judge Breyer. Juror number five, again, you did indicate that you had an attitude of you. How comfortable do you feel that, given your state of mind, who you are, how you live your life, that you could take those views and just put them to the side and decide this case just basic evidence? Juror number five, I would say I'm probably 90% sure I could do that. Judge Breyer, okay, 90% sure. Juror number five, sorry, I'd like to say 100%, but I can't guarantee. Judge Breyer, I think that's a very human, understandable response, because I'm asking you to predict the future, and that's difficult for a variety of reasons. Some people know exactly how they will behave in the future, and a lot of people don't know. A lot of people will say, I'm going to try to do this. That's all right if they really believe that their trying will be successful. That is, that they know themselves well enough to know that if they try to do something, they can, as a general rule, do it. To some people, this case and this defendant bring up experiences that they've had over the years that are highly personal. That can happen. For others, it has more to do with a question of beliefs and so forth. It's easier to put aside beliefs than the personal because the personal is highly emotional. So my question to you, juror number five, and I'm going back to your 90% for a moment. How comfortable are you that you can give Mr. Musk a fair trial here? Juror number five, I actually am a pretty logical person. Judge Breyer, okay, juror 11, can you set aside your feelings in judging this case? Juror number 11, I think given all the context you've given so far, I can say that I can. To the best of my ability, I will try. Judge Breyer, okay, let's explore that just a bit, because you're the only one who knows your feelings. We don't know your feelings. You know the depth to which you hold your feelings. You know how controlling your feelings may be in any situation. At least you've got a pretty good idea, and at least it's much better than my idea. So I need to rely on you. You cannot allow yourself to be influenced by sympathy, by prejudice, by passions, by views, opinions, and so forth. You can only be influenced by the evidence and the law. You're going to take an oath to promise to do that. So my question to you is, can you do that? Juror number 11, yes, I think I can. Judge Breyer, okay, number 37, you have no views. Juror 37, correct. Judge Breyer, however, you did indicate that you are active in the stock market. Juror 37, yeah, I have some money invested in the stock market. That's why I said I follow a lot of the tech stocks, including, yeah, Tesla and other stocks. Judge Breyer, okay, by show of hands, how many people here owned Twitter stocks? Some jurors raise their hands. Judge Breyer, okay, next question. How many people own Tesla stock? Not a Tesla car, Tesla stock. More jurors raise their hands. Juror 37, do you mean whether we directly own the stock, not as part of an index fund or mutual fund? I own index funds, so Tesla would be included. Judge Breyer, then everybody's involved in it. Okay, juror number 53. Juror 53, I pride myself on being a very fair, reasonable person and honest. Judge Breyer, great. Juror 53, I'm the guy that went to Costco and after I realized they made a mistake, a $10 error in my favor, I went back in and I paid them. Judge Breyer, let me tell you, everybody here would have done exactly the same thing. Do not think you are exceptional. That's a wonderful thing that you did. Maybe, can I have a show of hands? No, I don't want to do that. Okay. Juror 90, your view in the questionnaire seems to actually be larger than Mr. Musk himself. It seems to be a view of people who are in a particular class, right? Juror 90, correct. Judge Breyer, do you hold that view as you sit here today? Juror 90, correct. Judge Breyer, okay, thank you very much. Juror 96, I think that you also have strong views. Could you set them aside? Juror 96, I believe that in a criminal trial, I would feel morally obligated to convict. However, in a civil trial, I feel I can set those views aside. Judge Breyer, that's interesting. Juror 96, I'm happy to expand. Judge Breyer, sure. Juror 96, I believe it would be to the benefit of the human race were Mr. Musk to be sent to prison. However, I don't believe a loss of several hundreds of millions of dollars in a civil trial would be even a drop in the bucket to his wealth, so it really doesn't matter. Therefore, I would be able to consider the facts. Rulebook, A Day at the Races. From a selection of rules and regulations for diaper derbies that have been printed by American County Fairs. The parade and races are for babies ages 0 to 17 months. Fees vary. Contestant entry is free with fair gate admission. Return checks are subject to fees. If entering more than one child, please submit a separate application for each child. You and your child will be given a wristband that must be worn for the entirety of the event. Registration may be in advance or on the day of the event. Advanced entries appreciated, but crawl-ins accepted on the day of the contest. Parent or guardian must stay with child at all times. No drop-offs allowed. Participants must be in diapers. Diapers must be decorated. Diapers may be decorated by painting, sewing, or gluing. Suggestion, put the decorated diaper over a regular diaper. Diapers will be judged on creativity, appearance, and craftsmanship. First, second, and third place ribbons will be awarded for the overall cutest diaper. Only the parents or guardians listed on the application will be allowed past the rope sanctions during the race. We ask that one adult be at the starting line and one adult at the finish line, so no other people are allowed at the finish line other than one parent coaxing the baby. The coaxer must stay behind the line. Parents may use a bottle or toy to coax the child towards them. Contestants may be encouraged to crawl to the finish line by means of binkies, teddy bears, bottles, or other favorite toys. Parents or handlers are encouraged to coax their babies with any object they deem effective, with the exception of food, beverages, or small animals. These lures must remain behind the starting and finish line. A carpet will be placed on the ground for the children to crawl on. Babies must remain on the carpet. Crawling babies must crawl the length of the race or be disqualified. Babies must crawl on their hands and at least one knee. No walking. Infant contestants must not stand or walk during the derby. If a contestant walks at any time during the race, he or she will be disqualified, but will remain eligible for the cutest diaper award. Toddlers must walk the length of the race or be disqualified. Contestants must completely cross the finish line. The first contestant to crawl across the finish line will be declared the winner. You promise to abide by all the rules and regulations that pertain to the diaper derby contest. You have read and understood the rules. All decisions of the judges are final. Memoir. We must think about death. Yes, yes, yes. By Clancy Martin, from the 2026 edition of Noon. We must think about death. Yes, yes, yes. But I am also allowed to just think about death when I am dying, or to drug the thought away even then, or simply to pretend it's not happening. My mother is 85 now, and though in excellent health, taking long walks and doing her yoga, she may die any day. When she was my age, 58, I was 31, and I remember very clearly that she was an old lady to me then, no younger or older than she appears to me now. My son is 7, and he sees and sometimes comments on the sudden changes in my body, the skin loosening and wrinkling weirdly on my neck and on my arm at the bend of the elbow. I have been told by soothsayers on 3 different continents that I will live to be more than 100 years old, although I have never asked the question, and it may happen, though that means getting older and older with all that accompanies aging, and lately I look at pictures of old people with a new dread. Are they often about to drool? Why such scary smiles? Kierkegaard liked to say that man forgets himself. You could leave your umbrella at home and spend the day nervously watching the clouds, or forget your keys and fret for hours about where they are, or forget your wallet and feel bitterly certain that you have been pickpocketed, but forget yourself and not even notice. It may be that self-awareness is the art of nuance, but I may also prefer not to worry so much about my internal world, and I don't know, it might be better to bluster through life. Certainly I have known people who may have been happy in a jacket and tie, swaggering. And anyway, I have several times been in jail for a day or two longer, perhaps as long as a week. And there I always found that everyone had exactly the same questions about the meaning of life that have distracted me. A great writer named, oh boy, Ryosuke Akutagawa left multiple wills and suicide notes and letters for his children and friends before he took his own life. And they make interesting reading because he seems confident about the life he has lived and about his life skills generally. He even freely, unabashedly offers advice to the loved one he's leaving behind, this man who prayed for someone kind enough to come and strangle him in his sleep. One of those documents, a note to a certain old friend, is as famous as any of his brilliant short stories. He sounds like an ordinary person in all of the notes, unhappy, overconfident, resigned to a merciless tomorrow. Once a dear friend and teacher of mine visited me in Kansas City and I took her to the Buddhist wing of our museum. As we left, she said, "Wouldn't it be so nice to have something like that? Something you believe." It hurt my feelings a bit at the time, but now I see it differently. She has the long, hard, earned habit of trying to speak the truth. Life just pops up in every moment, and how can you possibly believe anything? She is a mother, my friend, and a teacher, and mothers do learn this awful art. She's a great writer, too, and telling the truth, I think, is hard for most writers. I want to mention the death of our Labradoodle, Simha, of which I am very ashamed. She ate one of our daughter's toys, and my wife could see she was very sick. I took her to the vet, but didn't stress enough how ill we believed her to be. My wife insisted she was dying. I thought my wife was worrying more than necessary, or exaggerating, as she tends to do, especially with sickness. She is a writer. Well, we went on a trip, and while we were gone, Simha got worse. By the time we returned, even I could see the truth. I called the emergency vet, and they explained I could bring her in, but she wouldn't be seen for 24 hours, and I was afraid she might die in a cage at the vet all alone. That first night we were home, I woke in the middle of the night and went downstairs. Simha came to me, moving slowly, obviously in pain, and I saw she wanted to go outside. We went to the backyard together, and she carefully walked out onto the lawn, trying to go to the bathroom, but not being able to, and she came back to me. I sat on the steps, and she rested her chin on my leg. I stroked her head, rubbed her ears. We sat like that for 10 or 15 minutes. Then I stood to go inside and asked her if she wanted to go in. She looked at me, and I could see that she knew, and I knew, that she was going to stay outside to die. In the morning, I opened the curtain of my son's window, looking for her, and there she was, on her side, her lips pulled back, showing her long teeth in the upsetting grin of death between two of my garden's beds. Yes, I am unhappy. Yes, I try to be cheerful. Yes, I see no solutions, but I also want to encourage everyone, especially my children. As I was lying in bed last night trying to help my son get to sleep, singing him a song he requested and liked when he was much smaller, I understood thoroughly, from the bottom of my heart, my life is completely falling apart. I have screwed everything up, and there is no way out. Today, things seem much, much better. So, in fact, it's not necessarily true that things only get worse. Sometimes the future is better than the past. Fiction. The Robot. By Maria Judith D. Carvalho, from And How Have You Been, which will be published this month by Two Lines Press. Translated from the Portuguese by Margaret Joel Costa. One random night, for no apparent reason, he was a wealthy man who had succeeded in life, Geronimo Gall tried to commit suicide. It wasn't a suicide that played to the gallery, carried out at a particular hour, after having taken a particular number of pills, and not one more. He knew perfectly well that his death would provoke a few cries of grief or shock, but that, with the exception of his father and mother, or not even them, distance temper sorrows. People, even though closest to him, would not have time for much more than that. Life was a long, long moving current that didn't stop for such insignificant things as the death of one man. Gall simply wanted to end, and this wasn't a new feeling, to end, to no longer play a role. That's why he chose to do it at night and took a whole bottle of pills. He didn't write to anyone, because he knew no one would understand. Not that he cared whether they did or not. He lay down and waited. By pure chance, one chance in a million, the maid, who was sleeping elsewhere that night, had forgotten to turn off a tap. The people in the apartment downstairs had been woken in the middle of the night by the sound of dripping water, and the lady of the house, while her husband rapped on Gall's door, was telling the rudely awoken concierge that she had met the gentleman on the stairs, possibly at 1 o'clock, when she was coming back from the cinema. Señor Gall was going up the stairs very fast, annoyed perhaps because the elevator was out of order, but he had still wished her good night. He was a polite man and a good neighbor. He lay in a coma for a few days. Then, one afternoon, he half opened his eyes and felt for the first time, the light but warm and caressing coverlet of sunlight on his legs. His third wife, who had left him some weeks before, came to see him, attributing his suicidal gesture to her leaving him, putting all the blame on herself. She wept as she asked him, "Do you want to start over?" He was still having difficulty speaking and found it hard to separate his thoughts, which were still squeezed together in the vicious mass that had wrapped around them. He could simply say, but the words have obeyed him, that no, that wasn't what he meant at all. Maya, however, didn't hear him, or did he not speak, because she promised him many things, among them being more understanding, adapting to changed circumstances, and naturally, love. The nurse came in then and saved him. He mustn't overtire himself, and his visitor's allotted 5 minutes had passed. With her came the aseptic aroma of an expensive pharmacy, which overwhelmed the perfume Maya had brought from London. Maya left, but not without turning around and shooting him her irresistible smile, the one she usually gave photographers or journalists when they were interviewing her about her latest role in her latest film. Then she was gone, and he was alone in that shiny room with its aquamarine walls, where the sounds of the outside world arrived diminished, soft, and terribly faint. His eyes were closing. He would like to stay there for a long time, half asleep, feeling that almost delicious tiredness in his weak body, floating between life and death, neither here nor there. This, though, proved impossible. A few days later, he was better. "Don't do it again," they told him, smiling and wagging a finger, while he felt with his hand for that mystical, non-existent, but necessary headache. Maya was caring for him, and she insisted on carrying his bag. He accompanied her like a docile little boy. When they arrived home, he glanced automatically at the mailbox, which was filled to bursting, but didn't feel for his keys, not yet. He entered the elevator, entered the apartment, sat down. Maya sat down, too, on the arm of the chair, and said, "Darling," and he felt obliged to give her an explanation, to tell her that she had misunderstood, that she wasn't responsible for what had happened, to tell her that she had not been the cause, and that he didn't want to remake his life with her by his side. "Is there another woman?" she asked. "No." "Do you take me for a fool?" He ran his hand over his forehead. "You don't understand, Maya." Then she talked and talked, but Gall wasn't listening, or only intermittently now and then. She said that he was an egotist, and that they had barely spoken during the 2 years they had been married, that she had gone back to the theater so as to have something to hold on to, since she clearly couldn't expect anything from him. That she must be right, and in a way she was. "You don't understand." When Maya left, feeling humiliated and indignant, Gall thought long and hard, looking for another way out. Perhaps there was another one, one that didn't involve pills. A search, a recounter, before. The phone rang. It was the office. They had learned that he had returned home and were calling to ask how he was. Senhora Gu, his secretary, was calling on behalf of all the employees. "We need you here, Senor Gall. There are so many letters needing a reply, and we really don't know." She should put them to one side, he said. "Of course, Senor Gall, but when do you think you'll come in?" "In a week or so, perhaps." "Not before?" "No." "And what about the conference in Moscow? Would you like someone to go in your place?" "Yes, send someone else."
"Who?"
"Wouldn't she like to see Moscow?" "In that case..." Senora Gu was speechless with happiness, unaware that, in that moment, she was perhaps starting to become a cog in the machine. He hung up, took a few steps about the house, went to the living room. Before, many years ago, he used to enjoy lying down and reading a good book. There were so many that he had never had time to read. He chose a book at random and took it with him, but couldn't get beyond page 20. He was no longer interested in reading. The maid appeared only later that afternoon, bringing the mail with her. She hadn't known that Senor Gall was back home and apologized for her absence, but her husband had been sick. Gall told her she could stay at home for a few more days. He was thinking of going to see his parents. "An excellent idea, Senor Gall. What you need is rest." Rest wasn't really the word he would use if he could explain himself, or if he knew how. He still didn't feel capable of driving, so he took the train, a slow, rickety old train that many hours later stopped at a tiny station as if it had run out of breath. This was the village where he had been born and had grown up, and where his parents still lived on a small farm. How long had it been since they had seen him? 5 years? Six? Would they have changed much? They hadn't changed at all. They were fairly well off and were amazed to see him. What was he doing there? What had happened? Was he sick? He didn't feel it necessary to tell them what had happened. He listened to them talk and say all the same things that had always filled their existence. He made an effort to respond, to ask questions. Then he went to bed, slept badly on his childhood mattress, and woke with the sun spilling over his body and his mother standing over him beaming. She had brought him his breakfast on a tray. "You used to love eating this bread when it was still hot. It's fresh out of the oven." Had he once loved that bread? He hesitated. The fact is that it was pretty insipid, exactly the same as all the bread he had ever eaten. He got up, dressed, and left the house, following the little track that had led to the lake. The old smell of the earth and the happy or anxious cries of the birds were all there, as was the blue-green iridescence he had never found anywhere else. It was still hot at that hour, and everything seemed to him just as it had been before. Static. It was as if the plants had neither withered nor sprouted nor grown, that they were the same plants as 20 years before, when he was 20. He sat down on a rock, the same one he always used to sit on, and looked at the water, which appeared still, but was in fact teeming with life, whose gentle voice he could hear. A shoal of fish swam by, mingling with the leaves drifting slowly along, blown by that wind. He reached out his arm and plunged in his hand to stir the water, clear water near the shore. Before, when he lived there, and later, when he came to spend his vacations there, his heart was filled with joy. He used to swim in that lake. He knew by heart all the dangerous places where there were sharp stones and sudden dips by the lake bed. His mother, up at the house, would shout, "Lunch!" But he would pretend not to hear, because lunch was just a waste of time, and he wanted to enjoy every moment. "Lunch!" shouted his mother in a slightly tremulous voice, quite unlike her old one. He returned slowly, but without hesitating, along that familiar track. He ate lunch, but the soup, once so delicious, had lost its flavor. "You're clearly not well," said his father. "You've got a headache, haven't you? You work too hard. Is it necessary to work so much? Your wife earns money too, doesn't she?" Was it Maya he was referring to, or the one before her, or his first wife? "Is it necessary?" his father asked again. Necessary? He worked neither for pleasure, nor because he needed to, but simply because he had to do certain things in a certain amount of time. "Why don't you give it all up and come and live here?" said his mother, convinced that he was now on his own. He'd had the same idea, which is why he was there, but the soup had lost its savor, and the lake no longer drew him as it once had, and time now seemed vast and endless. What would he do with a time so uncompartmentalized, which he wouldn't need or be obliged to use up? That was his problem, time. He either had to use it, surrendering it to the day's machine, or this. He left the next day and returned to the office. He read, signed things, listened, gave orders, spoke to Maya on the phone, for she had not given up, ate lunch on the run, went back to the office, spoke to Gui, who was en route to Moscow, accepted another invitation to another conference, this time in Berlin. Luckily, we also spoke German, arranged to have supper that night with some foreigners who'd happened to be passing through and with whom he had business to discuss, stayed with them until 2 a.m, and promised that the following day he would take them for a drive around the outskirts of the city. The following day, he would say, he would do things, he would make decisions. The next day, then the next, and next week, and next month, and the month after. Maya was right, and yet her idea of what was right and his. Before going to bed, Geronimo Gall made quite sure that all the taps were turned off. Facts. Landlocked and loaded. From a bulletin entitled Top Most Asked Questions that was issued in December by the Alberton Prosperity Project. 51st State versus Sovereignty. The objective of the Alberta Prosperity Project is for Alberta to become a sovereign nation, not the 51st state of the United States. In discussions that we have had recently with the U.S. State Department, they made it clear that they support Alberta sovereignty and are not willing to entertain statehood at this time. In fact, the U.S. Constitution requires that any region joining the United States be an independent nation first. Alberta would be landlocked and be very dependent on Canada for exports and imports. We would lose free trade and would face interprovincial tariffs. No, this is a fear tactic statement by those who do not want Alberta to be free and prosperous, but rather to be forever subjugated and pillaged by the federal government. In reality, Alberta is policy locked, not landlocked, by the federal government. The United Nations Convention on the Law of the Seas, Articles 124 and 125, require that every country shall have access to the sea. For example, Switzerland is also landlocked, but has no difficulty transporting products to ocean ports. Further, it would not be in the best interests of Canada or British Columbia to embargo Alberta, as a sovereign Alberta could block the transport of goods and services from east and west, including flyovers. Alberta would be subject to the terms of the Clarity Act and other constitutional unwinding unless it declares war. War won't be necessary, just a successful referendum, which is the legal pathway defined by the Clarity Act. Art criticism. Ways of peeing. From the Dog's Gaze, A Visual History by Thomas W. Lacour, which will be published next month by Penguin Press. Dogs that are represented peeing in public, in churches and town squares, mostly in a few 17th century Dutch genre paintings, seem harmless. Everyone relieved themselves in public in the days before public toilets. These dogs appear in service of the reality effect. But sometimes they get our attention in ways that suggest a moral judgment. In Otto Dix's painting, The Match Seller, for example, a dachshund, staring maniacally out of the frame, is peeing on a veteran of the Great War sitting on the sidewalk. It is a savage indictment not of the dog, but of the humans who hurry past, nothing visible but legs in flight. The dog is, at worst, clueless. It is the well-dressed humans who are metaphorically peeing on the beggar, to use the English colloquial expression. These aren't Dix's real targets. In German, one would say auf ihm scheißen, which is probably what Dix was saying but could not represent visually. Official versions. Shock and Awazi. From various translations from the Hebrew of an address delivered by Benjamin Netanyahu on February 28th, the day that the United States and Israel launched a joint military operation against Iran. The time has come for all segments of the people in Iran, the Persians, the Kurds, the Azeris, the Balakis, and the Awazis, to rid themselves of the yoke of tyranny and bring about a free and peace-seeking Iran, from the Israeli Prime Minister's office. The time has come for all segments of the Iranian people, Persians, Kurds, Azeris, Balochis, and Awahis, to rid themselves of the yoke of tyranny and bring about a free and peace-seeking Iran, from the Jerusalem Post. It's time for all the people of Iran, Persians, Kurds, Azeris, Balochis, and Akhvaz, to shed from themselves the burden of tyranny and bring forth a free and peace-seeking Iran, from Haaretz. The Iranian people, in all of their diversity, Persians, Kurds, Azeris, Balochs, Abkhazians, and all other citizens of this wonderful nation, this is your opportunity to establish a new and free Iran, from the Associated Press. Anyone who put down their weapons, including in the regime, will make sure that he is going to be safe. The Farsi, the Kurds, as are the revolutions there, this is your opportunity to put together a new free Iran. From CNN This Morning. Poem, The Ashtray, by Ryan Ruby, from A Manuscript in Progress. The ash in an ashtray is honest the way a hopscotch court drawn in peppermint chalk is honest, the way no writing, not even a diary, is honest, even though it too is a record of sorts, a record of the number of breaths drawn while writing at night. The child who drew the court yesterday afternoon understands something he does not know, that all impermanent things end. It is the same thing that his parents know but do not understand. The ashtray on my balcony was given to me by a journalist friend, who brought it back from Yerevan. It is shaped like a pomegranate. To fill it takes 3 to 4 nights of looking from my balcony at the creatures below. Teenagers, drunks, lovers, the lost, bats. As I was saying, no writing is honest. Consider what I've left out. To turn cigarettes into writing and writing into cigarettes, you need money, which in his paper Character and Anal Eroticism, Freud compares to manure. His ashtray is at the museum in North London. In his holdings, there is no chalk, and one nibbles a fountain pen. Discretion Advised, Francis King's Art of Concealment, by Charlie Tyson. A Domestic Animal, by Francis King. Like many Englishmen, the neglected gay novelist Francis King was a bit buttoned up, but the fault wasn't entirely his own. He was a product of a certain class, the son of a high-ranking colonel official in India, and education, Oxford. He emerged during that long, difficult mid-century gulf between the decorous concealment of E.M. Forster and the luxurious explicitness of Alan Hollinghurst. His first novels appeared just after the Second World War and accumulated at a steady clip across 6 decades. He wished to court a wide readership, to titillate the educated public without making housewives and barristers spit out their tea. So, while Forster chose silence, his gay love story, Maurice, was withheld from publication for nearly 60 years. King chose discretion. It helped, perhaps, that he did not think of himself as a gay novelist. His review of Hollinghurst's pastoral romp, The Spell, in 1998, captures his mentality. There is no doubt that this is a remarkable novel, but one wonders if Hollinghurst might not produce one even more remarkable if he were to decide no longer to be a gay novelist and instead become one who happens to be gay. Because King's career stretched so unusually long, he died in 2011 at the age of 88, and because love was one of his chief subjects, his corpus documents the evolution of norms governing the literary depiction of homosexuality. In his 1948 novel, An Air That Kills, for instance, we read of the spiritual bond between an uncle and nephew who swim together in the nude. The 18-year-old's sunburned limbs are blazed forever into the older man's mind. But later, as the boy rests his head on his uncle's shoulder, the reader is assured that nothing untoward is happening. It seems to me, the narrator observes, that the young go through life seeking their spiritual fathers and mothers, the old their spiritual heirs. Reflecting on the novel in 2007, King wrote, "If I were to write on the same thing now, I should handle it with far more frankness. And indeed, by that time, there was little need for such politeness." Privately, King accepted his sexuality without much fuss. Among friends at Oxford in the 40s, as he recounts in his memoir, Yesterday Came Suddenly, 1993, he made no secret of his inclinations. On a trip to Venice after the war, a smiling gondolier initiated him into an interlude on an isolated stretch of beach. But he was also aware of the violence and humiliation that an absence of discretion could invite. He maintained a certain guardedness. He distrusted flamboyance, claimed to go decades without crying, and felt irritated or embarrassed by anyone who was camp. A remembrance in The Guardian describes him as a strong supporter of the Conservative Party. As late as 1970, perhaps the highest praise granted to a gay couple in one of his novels is that their discretion is absolute. And yet, what makes King's constrained fictions compelling is that his discretion is not absolute. He is almost a quintessential English novelist of manners, coolly observant, slyly comic, straightforwardly realist in his approach. But not quite. Though impeccably bourgeois in his habits, he nursed an interest in the perverse, murder, cannibalism, incest, and other forbidden zones of sexuality are among the taboos against which his writing brushed. Reading a King novel is a bit like reading a work by Henry James into which someone has slipped at intervals script treatments for a B-movie. King is little discussed by critics or scholars. A search of an academic database yields a couple of dated encyclopedia-style entries, as well as one peer-reviewed article and one book chapter that touch on his work. Many of his novels are out of print. His reputation, as captured by obituaries in The Guardian and The Times of London, is one of genteel melancholy and precise social observation. But this is only a partial view of the tense and ruthless sensibility that achieves full expression in his best novels, particularly A Domestic Animal, published in 1970 and recently reissued by McNally Editions. Here we find the coupling of delicacy and brutality, reticence and release, that makes King one of modern British literature's great anatomists of repression. Born in 1923, King spent most of his childhood in India, where his father worked for the Intelligence Bureau. In Nainital, in the foothills of the Himalayas, servants doted on him. A photograph from this period shows a solemn blonde child dressed smartly in a tie and knee-high socks. India felt, he later said, like an earthly paradise, from which he was expelled at age 9 to attend school in England. In his 1983 novel, Act of Darkness, a 6-year-old boy in colonial India, blonde, pretty, pampered by servants, and betraying a vulnerable girlishness, is suffocated with a brassiere and tossed, his throat slit into a filthy latrine. Despite the luxury and princely attentions, the young king was surrounded by signs of decline. The empire was dying. So was King's father. When, as a boy, he kissed his father goodnight, he would taste a brine-like salt, a symptom, he eventually surmised, of the tuberculosis that would kill the family's patriarch when King was 14. Sudden death was very usual in colonial India, King later recalled. In England, King was spared some of the typical boarding school horrors, save for the hazards of English cooking. His memoir tells of one particularly disgusting cottage pie, all gristle, fat, and half-cooked potato and onion. The meal prompted a revolt, in which the boys dumped salt cellars and carafes of water over the foul pie, after which the mutineers were called into a back room, handed spoons, and forced to eat the mess. During the war, King, an avowed pacifist, was sent with his fellow contentious objectors to work the land. He remained in the countryside for 5 years. When he returned to Oxford to finish his degree, he had already published 2 novels. King considered an academic career, but he wanted to get out of England to see the wider world. More than that, he wanted to escape his mother. After her husband's death, she moved to London, where she proved eager to sacrifice herself for her children. Each act of self-negation, King thought, was a silken cord to bind me even closer. In his 1994 novel, The One and Only, the protagonist stabs his mother 47 times, blood of her splashing up onto my lips. It was because of this feeling that her love had the power to emasculate me and even destroy me, he wrote in his memoir, that once I had finished at Oxford, I opted to join the British Council. And so King became that classic figure, the Englishman abroad. During his more than 15 years working for the British Council, the cultural diplomacy arm of the British government, he was stationed in Italy, Greece, Finland, Egypt, and Japan. He taught classes, hosted dinners, glad-handed with ambassadors, dignitaries, and visiting writers. He made his living, in other words, as a representative of Britishness, erudite, ironic, gleaming with Oxonian polish. The sun had set on the British Empire, but the need for soft power endured. The time abroad stimulated King's imagination. He wrote novels set in Japan, Italy, Greece, and elsewhere. Other British novelists of the period, Graham Greene, Lawrence Durrell, Olivia Manning, were similarly international in their choice of setting and scope. But it is King's, as a functionary of a dwindling global power, who captures most stringently the psychic texture of imperial contraction. His novels are attuned to a distinctly mid-century English fear that the waning of international influence might entail a decline of English literature and culture. There is a telling scene in his novel, The Custom House, 1961, in which Japanese strippers dress up like Buckingham Palace guards for a cabaret number. What survives of empire is kitsch spectacle. Decline in all of its forms was, for King, an enduring fascination. His memoir, with its large cast of literary luminaries, has a revealing tick. A person will be introduced in the bloom of health and glory. Then King will cut to the future, telegraphing their doom or deterioration. He describes, for example, his friend Michael Swan, a handsome adventurer who won acclaim as a travel writer. After suffering heartbreak, Swan cut his throat and wrists in a bathtub. But the suicide attempt went horribly wrong, and Swan, once so handsome, so vivacious, and so brilliant, limped along, brain damaged, until years later he finally succeeded in killing himself. King's reminiscence of Richard Rumbold, a man with tall, muscular good looks, follow a similar arc. One day, Rumbold launches himself without warning out of a hotel window in Taormina, landing by a swimming pool surrounded by people, many of them children. Poor fellow, King adds with impressive sang-froid, he had always been inconsiderate. This fixation on decline was entangled, it seems, with anxiety about the fragility of literary fame. King had a sharp eye for lost looks, lost health, and lost discipline. His memoirs filled with depictions of half-forgotten writers at their worst. C.P. Snow knocks on his door one evening, asking to use the lavatory, his breath heavy with alcohol. Bernard Berenson appears at a luncheon looking pale and fragile, so close to death. We hear of J.R. Ackerley's descent into idleness, self-laceration, and drinking. This may go some way towards explaining King's own prolific literary output. Notwithstanding his obligations as a bureaucrat, he wrote more than 30 novels, as well as short stories, poems, plays, nonfiction books about Greece and Japan, studies of E.M. Forster and Christopher Isherwood, and a staggering quantity of literary journalism, much of it for the Sunday Telegraph, where he served for 10 years as theater critic. But King's productivity seems also to have had a deeper source. A boarding school memory recounted in his memoir gives a hint. On summer evenings, he would break off from writing poems or studying Greek and sit in a window seat looking down at the River Severn. The slope would be dotted with couples, usually servicemen and their girls. Then, he recalls, a feeling of desolation would come over me, an overwhelming melancholy at my own isolation. To escape the prison of this aloneness, King declares work was the key. But it was an ambivalent consolation. As I dedicated myself more and more to the writing of books, he muses on his memoir's final page, so joy, as distinct from contentment and even happiness, seeped out of my life. Findings. On the island of Golem Grod, a population of Hermann's tortoises, among whose aggressive and injurious male mating strategies has caused females to die of starvation or to kill themselves by walking off cliffs, was projected to lose its last female member in 2083. Thousands of Patagonian penguins are being killed by pumas, though many without being eaten. Emperor penguins, whose molting was observed from space, may no longer be able to safely molt before the annual disappearance of sea ice. Boat traffic may impede the social lives of harbor porpoises, and pilot whales and orcas were found to be carrying previously undiscovered viruses. Fire-footed rope squirrels appear to serve as a reservoir for monkeypox, which can jump to sooty mangabeys. Swine who escaped and rewilded in the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear disaster matrilineally introduced their rapid reproductive cycles into wild boars. Scientists reported that nanoplastics, which are released by cigarette butts even in still waters, make rice fish stupider and increase earthworm mortality. Eels in the silvering stage, wherein they attempt to escape to the sea, were captured for the first time in Cyprus's inland waters. The world's oldest fossil of reptile skin, discovered in the Thuringian forest, was theorized to include an imprint of a cloaca. Horses can smell human fear. Haptic researchers discovered a difference of two orders of magnitude in the elasticity of the 1,000 whiskers of an Asian elephant's trunk as they progress from the base to the tip. A monolithic quartz crystal consistently elicited attention from encultured chimpanzees who let it go only when offered bananas and yogurt and who can differentiate small crystals, even when they vary in luster, symmetry, and transparency, from pebbles. An ethicist concluded that gamifying workplaces is morally defective. The workplaces of CEOs who, as children, live through natural disasters tend to be safer, and still more so if the CEO is considered powerful and works in an under-unionized industry. 4/5 of Midwestern college students who have engaged in sex in a moving vehicle endorse the practice despite the risks. Whites are predominant among teenage American sextortionists, and Black and Latino teens possess greater resilience than white teens against online race-related disinformation. Folks, that's all the time that we have for today. On behalf of the Talking Information Center, this is Vicki. Thanks so very much for listening, and have a wonderful day.